1220 WGN.
Good evening, everybody. It's Karen Conti here. You know, it was a sad week, but it's not going to be a sad show. But I do want to just talk about a few things right off the bat. It was a very sad week for our nation. It was a sad week for our city. The shooting in Florida, as we all know, and we've been watching nonstop. But we had a tragedy here in Chicago as well. Our commander, Paul Bauer, was shot to death in broad daylight in the center of the Loop. And, you know, it's interesting. I was reflecting on this, and it really saddened me more than most stories that I've heard of these types of things with police officers. And I was coming out of a restaurant right across the street from the Thompson Center, right around the time that it happened. And I was intending to go over to the Thompson Center and buy a Valentine's Day card for my husband, and I realized it was too late. I had to get to another meeting. I said goodbye to my friend, the judge, who I was having lunch with, and I went to my other meeting and saw the commotion and didn't know what it was until later. And for some reason, and I don't know if you've experienced this, but when you hear about violence, whether it's a school shooting, whether you hear about a tragedy like a tornado, it's not real to you. You can feel sympathetic toward people, but when you're close to it and when you're connected with it, and when you say to yourself, I could have walked into that Thompson Center and I could have been close to where that happened, or I could have been shot myself. I guess it's your own selfish feelings, but it draws you together a little bit more. And I was thinking about Commander Bauer, and I think by all accounts he was a hero, and he was a person who kept us safe. And I just want to say that from me, and probably from most of the city of Chicago, we appreciate your service. The school shooting, and again, I don't want to go into it too greatly, but I was thinking, as a practicing lawyer, and many of you have listened to my show, and you know I'm a practicing lawyer, and I've sat in on legislative talks about how to change the law in different areas, and you think about what is it that we could do as lawyers and as legislators to change the law, to prevent something like this from happening. And the problem is, of course, that the perpetrators are, you know, they're terrorists. They may be troubled, they may be young, they may be not young, but they're terrorists, and they're not law-abiding citizens. In addition to that, they really don't, most of them don't care if they live or die, as we've seen. They're willing to either commit suicide or to be shot and get away just to walk away into oblivion, having done these horrific crimes. So how do we legislate? What kind of laws could we pass to try to help this? And of course we have the right to bear arms, Second Amendment. The Supreme Court has spoken clearly in the last 10 years, and it's clear that we have a right to have guns. Now, could we restrict the types of guns? I don't want to get into that. I know there are a lot of people feel strongly both ways when it comes to that. The other issue that is interesting to me is that it's very difficult to involuntarily commit somebody. So if you know somebody who has a mental health issue, who may be acting bizarre and depressed and maybe even is somewhat threatening, what is it that you can do? Unless a doctor signs an affidavit that says this person is a danger to himself or to others, you can't just take someone off the street based upon, I think he's crazy. And that's good. We have rights, and we don't want to be putting people in mental institutions against their will. But what about these red flag laws? And if you don't know anything about them, you should Google it. They are in California, Washington, Oregon, Indiana, and Connecticut. And I think it's also being considered in a couple other states now. But it allows the police to temporarily take away guns from people who the judge deems have some problems and significant problems, like repeated domestic violence issues, threats with credible ability to meet those threats, violence, substance abuse, not just substance abuse, but substance abuse coupled with threats. And perhaps that's the way to do it. We can identify people, and it looks like this kid in the Florida shootings was identified as a person who was making threats, credible threats, and he had guns, and he had depression, and he had issues. And at that point in time, maybe a red flag law could have had those guns removed. Not that he can't buy a gun, but that he could have those guns removed at least until his conduct was better. Again, That's my thought. I'm not sure how I feel about it. I'm not sure how those laws are working, but it's certainly something we should consider. Let's get to our first guest. This was a very interesting case. This week it was reported that an Arizona woman went to bed with a migraine headache. She had never been out of the country before, and she woke up with a British accent. This rare syndrome is called foreign accent syndrome, and it's of real interest to linguists across the country. Joining us tonight is the world's foremost expert in foreign accent syndrome, linguist Dr. William Katz, a professor of linguistics at University of Texas at Dallas. Okay. Welcome, Dr. Katz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Chicago. So tell our listeners, what is foreign accent syndrome?
Well, it's an unusual medical condition where patients end up producing disordered speech, but the hallmark is that it sounds foreign. And it's not really foreign, but it strikes listeners not as being slurred or disordered, but foreign.
You know, Doctor, Cash, can we play a little clip from this woman? She spoke out to the media, and I want you to listen, everyone, to her accent.
September 17, 2011 was the first time, and I was like, oh, yeah. Okay, something's really wrong with me, is all I'm thinking. Everyone only sees hears Mary Poppins. Who would do this for attention? I don't know.
So, to me, that sounds like an accent, but what is really going on? I know this is a complicated syndrome, but what is going on in the brain that changes a person's speech in this way?
Well, I don't really know this particular case, but there have been about 107 worldwide cases reported that I'm aware of like this. And first of all, the so-called accent, I guess we should call it a pseudo-accent, it's in the ear of the beholder. So what's happening to the individual is, for some reason, typically it'll be something like a stroke or sometimes a migraine or sometimes reasons we don't even know, something causes the speaking system to go awry. The timing gets off and so forth. You might have heard the melody sounds a little funny and the pitch sounds a little funny in that speech. And somehow that constellation of changes hits the ear as sounding foreign. I hope that kind of makes sense.
Sure. Well, and what happens generally with these people? Do they recover or do they consistently talk like that for the rest of their lives?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say in the cases that are out there, the majority don't recover. It's really based on the etiology, that is what caused it. There are cases, however, where there is recovery. I know there's several documented cases of recovery. And, again, it's sort of based on what caused the issue in the first place.
Does this syndrome lead you as a linguist to study other issues? And we're going to have to take a break in a minute, but is this something that we use to study maybe autism and stroke victims who have to learn to speak over again? Does this say something about the brain?
Well, we think so. For those of us who like this kind of thing, it's a kind of an experiment in nature, and we can try to look at those cases where there is a discrete cause, let's say a stroke in a certain part of the brain. There's a part of the brain called the insula where a lot of these cases seem to crop up, so that's interesting to us. Where it's caused by a more general problem, it doesn't really help us in that way, but we can maybe look at the behavior and try to understand something about how people perceive accent. So, yes, it really is kind of helpful to us.
We're talking to Dr. William Katz, professor of linguistics at University of Texas at Dallas, and we're talking about the foreign accent syndrome. When we come back, we're going to be talking to him a little bit about some of the other issues that revolve around the brain and speech. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. And we're talking foreign accent syndrome with Dr. William Katz. Dr. Katz, so this woman goes to sleep. She has a migraine headache. She wakes up with an accent that sounds very similar to a British accent. Apparently, she had this issue before and had awakened with like an Irish brogue and maybe something that sounds Australian in nature. Is it possible that because she heard these accents in a movie somewhere on television, she had never been to these countries, Could it be that her brain was imitating that in some way due to some trigger from the migraine? Oop. Dr. Kiss.
There's a couple of cases, there's a couple of cases called psychogenic foreign accent syndrome. That is, there are some cases where under kind of mental pressure, people can affect different accents. If people are off their meds, they can have what's called pressured speech and things like that. But in generally, it doesn't sound like it. And usually the experience that people have had don't weigh into this. So you might ask, why do people think it was an Irish brogue one time or British another or Aussie another? That's probably because in the ear of the listener, a lot of the listeners aren't that sophisticated. I'm not trying to be snooty or anything, but it's kind of hard to know those differences. And, you know, depending on where people are, typically these people with FAS are sometimes thought to be Slavic one time, British another time. That's what I meant by saying it's not a real foreign accent. It's a speech motor disorder that masquerades as an accent. So you really can't go to bed, you know, in Chicago as an American one night and wake up Irish the next.
That should
make people feel better.
No matter how much beer you drink.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Doctor, I want to kind of morph this conversation into some of the things that are maybe less rare, and even though they may not be exactly in your area of expertise, but the brain causes your ability to speak. I'm breaking this down as I know it. But how do you study that? You can't watch the brain process language. You have to just watch people who have these different syndromes.
But you can.
You can. Okay. Well, tell me.
Better.
Okay.
In the old days, the bad old days of these famous people, Broca and Wernicke, we did something called lesion deficit science, where we would look at a lesion or some part of the brain that was damaged and then the behavior and put two and two together. And kind of like maybe watching the person who wakes up British and saying, where is it in the brain? Which is very good. But nowadays we can even do better. We can do functional MRI scans. We can actually put indwelling electrodes into the brain. So researchers are able to watch language being processed in the brain, in people, in real time.
Oh,
it's absolutely amazing now.
Wow. So let's just talk about children who are autistic. And some children who are autistic cannot speak, and they have, obviously, they have thoughts, and obviously they have desires, and their brain is working. It's just that their brain doesn't let them verbalize. What, I know this is just a simplistic way of explaining it, but simplistically, what happens in the brain? What do we know about this?
Oh, well, now I am getting into waters that I'm not that versed in, but here's what I know. Autism is a developmental disorder, and it was identified, you know, in the 40s. And the main hallmark of it, you're right, there is a communication disorder component to it. That varies among kids. Some of them can be chattier. Some of them can be stone silent. But the main issue is a social interaction problem. Not being able to look others in the eye, not being able to get along with other kids. It's a social integration issue. And there's also a behavioral component. So those are the big three. And so there is something going on in the brain. We really don't know what it is. So that's a very active area of research currently.
And again, you know, just
that's kind of all I can say right now.
And if you, even though I know you're not an expert in all of these areas, but dyslexia, what generally happens in the brain when somebody is dyslexic and they're looking and they transpose numbers or transposes letters? What happens? Do we know anything about the cause?
Well, I want to put in a plug for the sort of mother organization that's really important here in the U.S. for this, the American Speech Hearing Association, also known as ASHA, A-S-H-A, ASHA.org, if anybody wants more information, because nowadays dyslexia is kind of considered in a bigger group of language-based learning disabilities. So you're right, these people have special reading problems, so we still know that. But as we've been looking at it, it appears to be part of a broader family of problems that a lot of kids have. Some kids have a little more on the writing side, and many of these reading and writing problems also seem to have a sound-based problem. They're called phonological processing disorders. So things like, you know, making rhymes and picking out rhymes of words, that seems to be a common basis to a lot of it. So actually some of these things are connected in a bit of an abstract way, but researchers drill down and they specialize in each of these areas in order to really try to help the people with these problems.
No, I understand. They're all probably different, but the connection here to me is the brain and the ability to speak. We only have a few minutes, but I had a father who was a wonderful man. He was a professional comedian, in, as a matter of fact, and he was extremely verbal, and was a great communicator. And of all horrible things that happened to him, he had a stroke and he lost the ability to speak, which was just horrible. But I found it interesting because he did try to learn to speak again, and no, everyone thinks it comes back to you and you start talking, but it's a whole process of learning how to actually formulate letters and words, and it's very difficult, especially at an older age. But I found it interesting that he still knew his jokes, and he could write them down, but he couldn't verbalize them, which was very frustrating for all of us. What do we know about this syndrome, or whatever we are going to call it, aphasia, I guess it is, from a stroke? What do we know about it?
Oh, yeah, that is my specialty. So
okay, there we go.
I can talk about that, too. Yeah, aphasia is the loss of language in adults after brain damage, and we know a lot about that, and I'm really sorry to hear about your father, and that kind of struggle regaining speech after a stroke has been intensively studied. We're getting better and better at trying to help people. I know there in Chicago there's some, you know, excellent people at the Rehab Institute and
yes,
several great places like that where they work with these folks, and there are wonderful new techniques. Usually working with speech-language pathologists will really help these people along, but it is a struggle. People struggle to come back, and my experience is every person is different. You'll find some amazing islands of preservation, maybe remembering their music, remembering their jokes, and
right,
so forth. But, yeah, it's often a struggle to get language back. Typically, the writing is on par with the spoken language if his brain damage was toward the front of his brain. But, yeah, and it's hard on the families.
It is. But
and you lose your sense of yourself when you're, you know, you can't speak anymore. People, unfortunately, the society thinks you're stupid.
That's exactly so. Right, and people would talk around him thinking he didn't understand. But you know what? People still have a quality of life, and it's still worth living, and we enjoyed him to the very end. But Dr. William Katz, I want to thank you so much. Dr. William Katz, professor of linguistics at University of Texas at Dallas. If people want to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
They can email me, wkatz@utdallas.edu.
Thank you so much, doctor. Take care.
Because I am an innocent man.
The Karen Conti Show. I'm going to give the phone number out here if you have any comments for any of our guests. Give us a call, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. At 8 o'clock, we're going to be taking your calls, so any calls you have about legal issues, breach of contract, small claims, family law, I'm happy to help you through your problems or try to direct you to the right place. If for some reason you can't get through to me or you want to talk to me more privately, I'm always happy to talk to you at my office and try to give you some direction. The number at my office is 312-332-7800, or better yet, send me an email at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Our next guest is Josh Tepfer, who's been representing the criminally accused for decades. He was first an appellate defender and then a professor and director at the Northwestern University Center on Wrongful Convictions. He's now with the civil law firm of Lovey & Lovey, which is the country's most successful civil rights firm with over $100 million of settlements and judgment for the wrongfully convicted and people who are victims of police misconduct. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Now, you are dedicated to the issue of wrongful convictions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And tell me, let's just talk about a couple of cases, and then I want to hear a little bit about how wrongful convictions happen. We hear about it, we watch it on television, but I want to get your read because you're right there on the ground actually litigating these cases. Let's talk about the Marquette Four, which reared its head this last week. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this case?
Sure. The Marquette Park Four is an example of what we call a multi-defendant wrongful conviction. So this is a case from back in 1995 where four children, four teenagers aged 15 to 19, were accused and interrogated and coerced into confessing to a double murder on a Southside auto lot. And those confessions sealed their fate. Now, it wasn't a trial, wasn't anything. It was a day after that this crime occurred, these four kids being brought to the station and browbeaten into a confession. And that locked them up, sealed their fate for about 22 years. I worked on the case for about 8 years. We got some post-conviction forensic testing, some fingerprints and palm prints from the crime scene, from multiple cars from the crime scene, and then a sticker from a stolen car from the crime scene, like a marketing sticker. And all of those fingerprints didn't point to the four kids who had confessed, but it pointed to a different 16-year-old boy who had nothing to do with any of these guys and who was part of a gang family, and that led ultimately to their exoneration.
Why wasn't the fingerprinting done right when they were convicted?
There was some fingerprint that was done when they were convicted and excluded them. The technology, like DNA, like some other technologies, improved through the years, so we were able to do some new fingerprint testing and put it in what's called the APHIS database. So there's this DNA database of called CODIS, and there's also a fingerprint database, and that matched to this convicted felon in multiple spots. What we also learned is that fingerprints from the sticker were sort of hidden from the public view for a long time and hidden from the defense attorneys and the defendants themselves. So that was a real big problem as well.
Is that a problem in a lot of these wrongful conviction cases where there's withholding of evidence that might exonerate the defendants?
Sure. I mean, wrongful convictions, you know, happen for all sorts of reasons. They happen because of mistake. They happen because people like you and me and human error, and people lie. People have their flaws. But what I've come to realize, especially over the last half decade of doing this, is lots of times wrongful convictions are no mistake, and they happen from misconduct, whether it's prosecutors, whether it's, and far too often in this city, from police misconduct, hiding of evidence, coercing confessions, and going back to the Marquette Park Four. I mean, one of the reasons we know that these were intentionally fabricated confessions is because these four kids all had interlocking confessions. They all blamed each other or blamed themselves altogether. Now we know all that was made up, and there's only one explanation for how that happened. That's the police fed that.
So many questions. Let's go to the issue of their age. Now, these were kids, okay? They're in the wrong place at the wrong time, apparently. And what right does a minor have to have an adult present while there is a police interrogation?
You know, let's back up. They weren't in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were picked up and grabbed as African-American youth. And, you know, what Illinois allows, and all states are different, is, you know, some sort of attempt to contact the parent, but police don't need to make much of an attempt, and there's no requirement that they're there. Really, all it is this, what they call this very vague totality of the circumstances test. Is your will overborne? Is it voluntary? But the problem, what was going on for so long, is it was under this veil of secrecy, right? I mean, here we are. We're out in the open right here. Everyone can watch us.
Michigan Avenue. Yeah.
People are waving to us as we go. Everything's out in the open now. But in the most important part of any criminal case, which is your interactions with the police, it's this veil of secrecy. They're not recording it. No one knows what happens. And for decades and decades, it would be these kids, these black kids or Hispanic kids that versus these esteemed police who say, and they told one story of what happened, that they were browbeaten, that they were told what to say, that they were threatened with the death penalty, that they were physically abused, that they were tortured. We saw that versus the police saying, nope, I followed the FOP, I followed the rule book to the T. And over again, judges and prosecutors and even defense attorneys for years and years just believed the police over the kids. And we're starting to see a little sea change of that now.
Now, these kids, I just have to get the fact out. You said they, I said the wrong place, right, you know, wrong time. They weren't. They just picked these people up, and how did they come to conclude that they did it?
You know, there's always a question in this case. In this case, all we know is that there is a unknown confidential informant who told the police that one of the four defendants, a guy named Troshan McCoy, a 17-year-old kid in the Marquette Park 4 case, had some information about it. I've litigated this case for a decade. To this day, I still do not know who that unnamed confidential informant is.
And you don't have a right to know that as a criminal defense lawyer or a person who spends 20 years in jail.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other reasons that we have these wrongful convictions, whether they're intentionally brought, some of these prosecutions, knowing that the kids didn't do it, or they're truly mistakes. That's something I want to talk to you about. We're talking to Josh Tepfer with Lovie and Lovie, and it's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Josh Tepfer and with the Exoneration Project, and we're talking about wrongful convictions, and there's so many of them over the last 20 years that it's just hard to even name them. Here's my question to you. I know that people make mistakes, and there's going to be wrongful convictions, and there have been since time began, but do you see, what does a prosecutor or the police officers, do they think somebody's guilty and then they maybe stoke it and maybe find some evidence that wasn't there in order to convict the person? Or do they know right from the beginning, generally, that this person didn't do it, but they just have to put this crime to bed?
Both. I mean, there's tunnel vision. There's exactly the scenario that you get, and there's well-meaning police officers and prosecutors who make mistakes. But what you've seen so routinely in this city in particular, and really throughout the country, is just the routine, intentional fabrication of evidence. And perhaps the best example, and what I've dedicated sort of the last couple of years of my life working on, is this situation that went on throughout the 2000s in the Ida B. Wells housing projects. And that was really what we know now was, for a decade, this Sergeant Ronald Watts, who's now a convicted felon, and a team of his officers were just running roughshod over this community. They were basically running their own drug line. They were doing it, and anyone who wouldn't cooperate with them or anyone who would seek to expose them, they would retaliate against. And what we saw is, so far, what we've uncovered over the last 2 years is roughly 30 overturned convictions, 30 times where we have now had a judge and the prosecutors in Cook County say these officers framed these individuals, just intentionally made up a drug crime. And that's extraordinary. And really what we're looking at is it could be upwards of somewhere in the area of 500 cases. Wow. That we're looking at. And what I've been doing, what my colleagues have been doing at the Exoneration Project, is going back and reexamining all of those. And one of the nice things, one of the good parts of this story, is we now have a prosecutor's office, Cook County State's Attorney, who is assisting in that endeavor. And we're working cooperatively to help uncover this. And what we saw in November was the first mass exoneration in Cook County history. And that was when 18 convictions were overturned of 15 men, all based on this Watts scandal.
Amazing. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. We have Mary wants to know, if a person is deemed to be actually innocent, exonerated, what is the compensation for them? Is there some automatic compensation? I think we all know that you can then file a civil lawsuit to try to say that this was a wrongful conviction. Those are hard cases to bring. They're hard cases to prove. But your law firm has done a really good job in those cases throughout the history of the firm. What is a person entitled to from the state?
Sure. Well, there's a process. If you become exonerated, your charges are dismissed, where you can seek a certificate of innocence. And actually, we were in court last week for those 15 men, like I told you, where 9 of them were granted a certificate of innocence. And the burden is to show not just that your conviction was overturned, but by that it's more likely than not, by the preponderance of the evidence, that you're actually innocent of that crime. And if you are found actually innocent, so it's a new proceeding, then you're entitled to some amount of statutory compensation. It depends on how long you've been in prison, but it's anywhere from roughly $85,000, $90,000 to about $215,000. So if you go away for 30 years, you get about $215,000. If you go away for 5 years, you might get $85,000. And there's all sorts of complications with that, too. As you might have heard, our state doesn't always pass a budget on time.
Right.
And so we had people waiting for 3 years who had been certified innocent to get these checks that were due to them and, you know, didn't come.
And, you know, again, I think there are some people out there who say, oh, you know, why should we care about it? You know, the system is always going to have its faults. My opinion is that we have had more than our share in this city, and it's costing our city hundreds of thousands of dollars. I looked at a stat that said that over the last 14 years, the city of Chicago alone has paid about $642 million to for wrongful convictions and these types of things relating to John Burge, the commander who was torturing victims and these types of things. So this is actually costing the taxpayers a lot of money, number one. And number two, there are people who actually committed these crimes who walked free and probably are perpetrating crimes again. So I think we should all really make a point of paying attention to this stuff to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I admire you for being what you call yourself as a reformer. You know, you are hoping that by defending these people and bringing these issues to light that you're going to change the system. And that's what I want to talk to you, the last thing I want to talk to you about is you mentioned that this prosecutor, Kim Fox, is being a little bit more helpful and a little bit more receptive to the idea that there's wrongful convictions. I see this all the time all over the country. There's clear evidence that a defendant spent time in jail, didn't do the crime, and yet the prosecutor will not relinquish, you know, and will not say the person's actually innocent and will fight it. Why? Why do you think that happens from a standpoint of a prosecutor?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's really hard to admit you're wrong.
I do it all the time, except with my husband. I do it all the time.
I'm big into saying sorry. I say sorry a lot. But I think there's an instinct hard to say you're wrong and hard to say I'm sorry. And I think the biggest systemic problem is the prosecutors around the country are so tied to the police. And like we've discussed a lot of this, a lot of times this is no mistake. A lot of times this is intentional misconduct or police misconduct. And so when you have prosecution offices that need their police, they need them every day in court, they need them to go there, they need them to testify, to build their cases. In every case, I've been a criminal defense lawyer, or doing criminal defense for 15 years, I've never seen a case where a police officer didn't testify. It just always happens. And so they need them every single day. And when you have those same police officers that you need, and then you're turning around and saying you got it wrong, and they don't think they got it wrong, or they know they cheated, you know, that's a tough thing for a prosecutor to overcome.
But now we have more transparency. I think we all agree that when we have the Laquan McDonald shooting on national television, and we know that maybe things weren't brought out when they should have been brought out for whatever reason, without pointing fingers, but I think people get angry, and now they look at the prosecutors a little bit more critically, don't you think, and say, well, what are you doing about this, and why are you, you know, why are we doing what we're doing?
Well, I think there's not the knee-jerk reaction to assuming the police are always telling the truth at this point. And so I think there is, at least in this city especially, there's a level that we've seen, the DOJ being here with the Laquan McDonald, with some of this Watts stuff, where the police are starting to be held accountable. And I have friends on the police force. I hope
so. Do I?
Are listening?
And they're the most wonderful, heroic people I know.
And the ones who do it well, they are as burdened by this,
of course,
of this police misconduct than anyone. It affects them. The distrust by the community that
makes it dangerous for them to do their job. How about that?
Absolutely, not dangerous and more annoying because everyone's recording them all the time.
Right.
And it just makes it more difficult. And so, I mean, it's cleaning up misconduct, cleaning up police misconduct, which has just been woefully inadequate in this city for ever, it should be a top priority because it benefits everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Josh Tepfer with Lovey and Lovey and the Exoneration Project. If anyone wants to reach you, how would they reach you, Josh?
Sure. You can just reach me at jtepfer@uchicago.edu.
Thank you so much. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Karen Conti Show, and this is the point in the show where you get to call and ask me any legal question that you have, whether it's about a topic you've heard about in the news, whether it's a problem that you have or a friend of yours has on any legal issue. I'll try to give you my very best answer or at least get you to the right place. The numbers here are 312-981-7200, and you can text to that same number, 981-7200. And just so you know, while you're all calling and dialing, and we don't dial anymore. You push button. Why do I say dialing? I guess that I'm old fashioned. I want to talk a little bit about what I like to do. If you don't get a hold of me for some reason or you'd like to talk privately, I'm always available at my office. I'll give out those numbers, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. And sometimes what I do is just refer you to an organization or maybe a legal clinic or something that where you can get some information, or I can send you some information that I've Googled and I've found for you where you can get information about where to go to solve your problem. This was interesting. About 6 months ago when I was still doing the Brian Noonan show, I had a call from a person, and I really can't talk about the details, but the person needed a lawyer, and there was a very serious personal injury in his life, and I referred him to a person who I knew as a personal injury lawyer, because I don't do personal injury myself, who actually practiced and had a very similar case. I was able to refer this person to that lawyer, and within 6 months, there was a settlement, and this is very unusual, but it was over $4 million, and I was shocked, I was surprised, I was really extremely pleased for the client. But I think it's not because I'm the greatest lawyer in the world, but I think it's because I know who the good lawyers are. If it's something I can handle, I'm happy to do that. But mostly, I'd like to connect you with a lawyer who is good in your area, maybe is in your neighborhood, maybe practices law in that area, someone I trust, and someone I know who will handle your case in a way that's competent. So that's where I'm going to give you some value at my office. Again, it's WGN@askkarenconti.com. But right now, the number is 312-981-7200. You know, Cash, my producer, came to me with a legal issue that a family member has. Cash, do you want to talk about that on air?
Yeah, we can talk about
sure.
it. So it's actually my mom.
Okay. Hi, Mom.
Yeah, shout out
listening?
To Mom.
She listening tonight?
I don't know.
Your mom doesn't listen to you.
I mean, sometimes she does. Depends on what she's doing.
Doesn't that get you mad? Like, why wouldn't your whole family want to listen to you?
I know, right?
They listen to you enough, but I mean...
Yeah,
really.
I don't get too mad. When I was in college, they listened to my show every Monday morning, so...
Now it's old hat, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm like, yeah, we're
okay,
used
to Mom, we'll see what we can do. Tell me the issue, Cash.
Okay, so she signed a contract with this roofing company rep
okay.
that was going under one company name, and we'll just call them AO for now.
Okay.
And she made the mistake, you know, of not reviewing the contract, and she didn't get a copy of it either, just their business card. So then she received a check from her insurance company, unaware of when the roofing company even met with the insurance company to get that secured. So she gave the rep the check. However, the rep failed to appear for three separate appointments, including one at her mortgage company, and she goes to Wells Fargo because they had to, like, both sign off on the check for repairs.
So let me just guess. She had some damage that was covered by insurance. The
right.
insurance company was going to pay for it, but the insurance company required the roofing company to go through some hoops to make sure that that money was being spent properly.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the roofing company failed to meet three separate times, and she has a witness for one of the meeting times at Wells Fargo.
Okay.
Because, you know, that's where they agreed to meet. They failed to meet, so then she finally got a copy of the contract from her insurance company, and it's issued out through a completely different company called Bella Vista Public Adjusters.
Okay.
So, you know, now she's telling them, like, you know, well, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, can I cancel this? Because this is too much. She's been dealing with this since July of 2017.
Wow.
And both companies now, because she's talking to two separate reps, claim that they're both under the same company when they're not, are saying that she has to pay 25% of the insurance check in cash.
This all sounds bizarre. Now, I haven't had a chance to look at the contract, and you did email it to me once the show started. So that's the first place you always go for a legal issue. You say to yourself, you know, is there a binding contract? And a contract can be a ticket. It can be a purchase order. It can be the rules online for something that you've purchased. So you always need to check on that. So without reading that, I don't know exactly what they were supposed to do. But let me ask you this. Did the insurance company take a position on this? Are they trying to get this done with the company as well?
The insurance company stopped the first check.
Okay.
So that way nothing
could
happen with it. But they reissued another check and said that that the public adjuster must sign on it because it is a public adjuster. But they haven't signed anything. So now my mom has this check. The roof is still damaged.
Well,
and she's just stuck.
So she wants to go to a different company because
she's
lost all trust in this company.
Exactly.
Okay.
But they're claiming that...
because she signed on the dotted line, she's obligated.
Exactly. To pay 25% of it in cash. In check, just in cash.
Well, that sounds fishy right from the beginning. What I would do is I take the position in writing that, dear company, you breached your contract by not complying with meeting me at this place where you're supposed to meet me. I have witnesses that you weren't there. I've lost confidence in your ability to do the job. I hereby terminate the contract and then go hire someone else to do it. The company, are they really going to sue? I doubt it.
She doesn't know what they're going to do. She sent them a letter, and she's filed a complaint with the Attorney General, and then she's also had Legal Shield send this company an email. And every single time, she'll get a response from either or a company. So they'll use, like, Legal Head from one of the other names of the company, saying that it's a completely different account of what really happened.
Yeah. So I think you have to make a decision. You either go with them and hope that they're going to do the job, which I think is stupid because I think you know, they've already proven that they're not reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the Attorney General's office probably, it's good that she filed that, and that's fine. There's no harm to doing that, but they don't really handle these types of things unless there's probably 10 of them, and then maybe they'll investigate it. So I think that what she should do is just say what I said, that, you know, that this is a breach of contract. They breached the contract, and when another party breaches the contract, that exonerates you from all liability under that contract, and then move forward, and then get the insurance company on her side to support the idea that this company, it's July, and they can't get this job done. This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But let's do this. When I get to work tomorrow in my casual clothes because it's President's Day, I will take a look at that contract, and I will see if there's anything in there that helps us one way or the other.
Awesome.
Okay?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Listen, their phone lines are open. 981-7200, any legal question, 981-7200. And about 8:30, we're going to do something fun. We're going to do a little President's Day trivia where I'm going to call her on the line, and there are valuable presents and valuable gifts if you get more than 50% of the questions right. So we'll do that at 8:30. But meanwhile, you're listening to WGN. Taking your calls now, 312-981-7200, on any legal topic. Let's go to them. Let's go to Randy. Randy, welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Oh, God, it's great to hear from you. I got a simple question here. My father died 4 years ago, and his wife died in September. A will was sent to each of 8 people in the will, and it was filed in November on the 17th. How long should we wait for the money's disbursement?
This is a question that I hear all the time. I've got a text on this very issue. First of all, the process is slow, okay? And do you know if the will is being probated, meaning is it in court?
Okay, what the information I got, it says this is a petition for probate or a will.
Okay, so it's going
letters of testimony.
Okay.
But there is no there's no real estate. There's only money involved, over $100,000.
Okay.
To be divided among eight people.
All right. There's certain time limits that they have to give notice to creditors and things like that. So that takes a little bit of time because they have to leave that open in case there are people who come there and say that the decedent, the person who died, owed them money for some reason. So there's some time deadlines that are going on right now. But the process can take a while. I've seen probate go for 4 or 5 years. I hope it's not going to be that case. But the executor of the will is the one who probably drives it. The court ultimately has to approve of all of the distributions of money. So the executor has to get all of the debts in, has to figure out what the assets are. That doesn't sound like it's complicated in this case of what you're telling me. And it should be done quickly, but the court system really kind of weighs it down. And that's one of the reasons why I tell everybody, go to an estate planning lawyer who can probably put your stuff in a trust so it doesn't go through probate, so you can avoid the court system. Because if you have
I didn't have any choice in the matter.
No, I know. You're not the one. No, I get
it. And I didn't know nobody know this money was coming. I have one other question. The executor of the will, which is her sister, there is an HL next to her and her brother's name, but to the other side of the family, which is my dad's side of the family, where it says legal or legal TL, there's an L. What is the H?
I don't know. I don't really practice in that area, but, you know, I don't know. And it's something I probably, if you send it to me, I can walk down the hall and find a lawyer who can tell me that. But good luck. The process is slow, and one of the things that I'm saying to Randy, not that it was his fault, but that for everybody out there, you should get a lawyer who's going to put together an estate plan that makes sense, that keeps it out of probate, keeps it out of court, and keeps the lawyers to a minimum. Gary, welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a legal question about a discrimination case?
Oh, hi. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, what are the laws about discriminating against seniors, especially disabled seniors, when you're trying to conduct business, but they say, well, You can email us here and we'll email you back. And we have no knowledge about computers or emails or anything. It seems to happen like every other day with seniors.
Yeah. You know, I understand. I feel your pain. There are a lot of people who don't have access to a computer and don't know how to work one and don't have anyone to help them with that kind of thing. It's really unfortunate, and there's no real laws that say that people have to call you or people have to be able to mail things back and forth. I don't know of any law that protects you in that realm, but sometimes you can go to the public library and have someone help you with that, but there's really no law that I'm aware of that you can assert to basically tell people that they have to use something other than a computer. But thank you for the call. Let's go to Julie. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi. Just have a question. My daughter has a full-time job, but she had a part-time job working in a doctor's office, and he had to let her go back in November and has promised her to send her check and just doesn't. My suggestion to her was I thought she could just go to small claims court, but everybody's like, oh, the fees are going to eat up. It's only like $500, but it means something to her. It's why
sure.
she had...
Okay, Julie, here's what you should do. The Illinois Department of Labor Wage Claim Division has a process that where you can fill out a form. Pretty sure you can do it online now. It used to be you had to do it in triplicate, but I'm sure it's online. And you fill it out and you give them all of the evidence that you have. This is when I worked. This is the paycheck I didn't get. This is how much I'm owed. This is when it was owed. Here's my letter to him explaining it, and he didn't give me the paycheck in time. And they will investigate it, and they will send him a copy of the complaint, and they will investigate it, and they will fine him, and they will order him to pay if they find it. Now, this is a slow process, but it's a free process for you, which is good. And when you get a letter like that, the Department of Labor is not someone you want to mess with because they can fine you and they can give you treble damages and they can do an audit of your books. And so that's really the way to go. Illinois Department of Labor Wage Claim Division. All right?
All right. Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Julie. Let's go to Barry. Barry, welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Your legal question.
Yes, I have a federal civil litigation, and I filled out an interrogatories with my lawyer, and on I was trying to satisfy the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and instead of 13 grievances, when I appeared in front of the judge, it said 13 pages. So therefore the grievances weren't entered into evidence. So therefore, I don't know if I'm going to lose the Prison Litigation Reform Act, even though I don't think the Administrative Review Board of the Department of Corrections has the right to grant monetary or medical needs.
Okay, Barry, this is out of my area completely, and I'm going to put you on hold. Generally speaking, interrogatories, Barry was talking about interrogatories, and those are written questions. It's a tool of discovery and litigation so that each party gets to ask certain questions like, if this was a prison issue, how long were you incarcerated? What are your damages? What are your medical bills? And those types of things. I don't really understand what he's talking about, grievances versus interrogatories, and I'm going to ask Barry to give me an email at the office with a little bit more detail, because this is I'm not quite clear of what your legal issue is, and that is WGN@askkarenconti.com, and that's KarenConti, KarenConti.com. I have just a few seconds. Let me just, is this Jim? Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You've only got a few seconds.
Hi.
Give me your issue.
Okay, we were involved in an arbitration case. I was the defendant, and we were awarded the first suit was found as wrongful termination.
Okay.
And we countersued them and won the countersuit, like 100% of that. The plaintiffs rejected that award and wanted to bring this to trial, and I just wanted to see what your thoughts were about that, because we were sent to arbitration from a judge.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to answer your question as best I can. But again, I'm going to tell you to send me something via email, because I need some more facts. Generally speaking, arbitration is binding. So there may be an idea that this is binding arbitration. So if they reject the award, I'm not sure if they have a right to go to trial, but if there's some paperwork that says that they do, then it looks like you are going to go to trial, because if one party rejects an arbitration that is not binding arbitration, then you're back in court and you're going forward with the case in court. But send me your documents, send me maybe the arbitration agreement, and I can see what your rights might be to proceed. Again, if the contract says that it's not binding, then it looks like you're heading to trial. And that is WGN@askkarenconti.com. Give us a call here with legal questions on the other side of the news, 312-981-7200.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law?
Karen Conti here on WGN. I'm taking your calls on any legal topic you might have. Give me a call here at 312-981-7200 or text to 312-981-7200. And if you don't get your call in, 312-332-7800 is my office line. Let's go to Brian. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show. Do you have a legal question?
Yes. I get blinded, and I was working at this place. They put me on long-term disability for like nine years. Now they're saying that they had an internal review that I got to pay back the long-term disability money.
No.
I got to pay back on 1/4, and they got to pay back 3/4 since it's their fault.
What is the basis for this?
They just said that they had an internal review, their own papers, and then that they overpaid me.
Well, how much money is at stake? It's got to be a lot of money.
$49,000.
Okay. So let me ask you, Brian, were you blinded as a result of a job injury?
No.
Okay. So you were blinded, and they determined that you were disabled, and they put you on the long-term disability that your employer provided. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay, are you telling me that they didn't tell you why their internal audit changed their mind after all these years?
Well, they said they had internal investigation, and that they said they overpaid me $49,000, and I got to pay back $9,000 of that.
Okay. Does your employer have a position on this? Have you spoken to anyone at your employer's office?
It's through the insurance company. They're talking to me through insurance.
Okay. You know, that's just astounding. I would want to see the paperwork where they told you why. I'd like to look at it, and I think you have to fight it. Now, my guess would be is that because we're dealing with insurance companies, there's probably a procedure for you to appeal that process, meaning they can't just say you owe that money back. There has to be a way that you can fight it and that you can assert yourself in an appeal process. So that's something that you probably have some time deadlines ticking. So why don't you send that to me as soon as you can? Send me the paperwork, everything that you can send me in an email, and I will take a look at it, and I will tell you what I think and maybe give you a referral to someone who can handle this for you. Okay, Brian?
Well, I'll try it. Well, I'm visually impaired, so I don't know about the email, but I'll try it here.
All right, Brian. Take care. Good luck. And that number is 312-332-7800. And the email, which is always the best way to get a hold of me, because then if there's something I can send you back, I can just send it back to you very quickly. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. The important information is what happened to you, where did it happen, like what county, how long ago it happened, because sometimes there are statutes of limitations that will prevent you from having some sort of relief, and basically what you're looking for. Okay, those are the pieces of information that I would need. Let's go to Kim. Kim, welcome to the Karen Conti Show. What's your legal question?
Hi, Karen. I have a question. So my question is let's say that a family member is doing drugs and they are not suitable to take care of their child, and they write up some type of legal guardianship, let's say, and they say, you know, I, Joe Rose, being a sound mind and what have you, cannot take care of my child, and if there's any time that my child, not endangered, but I cannot take care of my child at any time, then it can go to my cousin, whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So, like, and so having, like, so if, let's just say that person who would be bequeathed the child would have a written, like, a written agreement, and they get it notarized, written agreement from that person being in sound mind at that time.
Okay.
And then have it notarized.
Yeah. This is not something you can do by agreement. And this is not something you can, you use the word bequeath, and I'm not, It's just interesting because you can't give a child to somebody. You have to, this has to be something that is official in that
right.
If there is
right.
a parent who is unfit, now you
right.
can't really say I'm unfit, but, and if I get more unfit, you can have my child. It either,
right.
that person is either fit or not fit, and that has to be determined by a judge, and there has to be a guardian appointed, and it has to be
right.
done in a very formal way. Unfortunately, it's not a cheap process if you have a private lawyer. Why don't you give me an email at my office, and I have a lawyer who does only guardianship type work, and if there's a free way to do this, if there is an inexpensive way to do this, then she's going to be able to tell me that, okay?
I really appreciate you helping, because here's the thing. It's that this child is 3 years old, and the mother does drugs, and, you know, a family member is like, well, if anything happens, you'll be the guardian. And I'm like, you can't do that. You have to have things written, and they don't want the child to go to DCFS.
Right. Well, and that's one of the problems that, at least
right.
in the past, when you went through this process, the child might be placed in a temporary home while these decisions are made, which is very heartbreaking. But generally, they try to place the child in a family environment where this child's going to have continuity and continue to go to school and not have any bad things happen. But, you know, you have all kinds of issues as a guardian. I mean, you have responsibility for that child. You know, you can sign that child up for school. So all of those things need to be legally in place if you're going to be serious about taking that child into your custody.
And there's also, I mean, I know probably people might call in or ask you even, saying, well, what about, you know, honestly, the legal, I mean, because God forbid something should happen to the mother. So then everyone's like, oh, well, then we go to the father. Well, the father is not an option because his apparent family doesn't even know this child exists. So, and this guy's in jail or what have you. He's unavailable.
This is even more confusing then, because that has to be dealt with as well, because generally speaking, the two parents, the two people who are obligated to take care of a child and have the rights to take care of a child are the two parents. So if the mother falls because she's unfit, then the child would go to the father. If he's unfit, he's also got to be deemed to be unfit. And then, and then we have the third choice. So,
the mother of the not so good mother is not even an option because she doesn't want to have anything to do with her at all.
Okay.
So that's why I throw in there the guardianship, and you would have to have some type of legal bearing. But
yes,
I'm going to email you.
Okay, Kim, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give out my email address. It's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. One more text that we got from the 630 area code. Interesting. What is an implied contract? I hear a lot of people use that term, and I'm glad I have a chance to explain it. A contract, there can be an oral contract, and there can be a written contract. An oral contract is, I agree that if you give me that baseball mitt, I will give you $20. That's an oral contract, and if you give me that baseball mitt and I don't give you $20, you could conceivably go to court and enforce it. Obviously, a written contract is something that is signed. It has the pertinent terms of the contract, and both parties agree to be bound by the terms of that contract. An implied contract is something that is not specific enough to be called an oral contract, but it is implied in law. I would say a good example would be I get into a taxi cab and I tell the taxi cab I want to go to 435 North Michigan because I'm doing my radio show, and he takes me there and I get out of the cab and I don't pay. Well, was there a contract? Yes, there was a contract. It was not orally stated. I didn't say, I will pay you, and he didn't say, yes, I'll take you and you will pay me. There was certainly no written contract, but it is implied that when I get into a taxi cab in the city of Chicago and they take me to my destination, there is a charge, and I agree to be bound by it by virtue of me just getting in that cab. That's an implied contract. It's implied in the law. So hopefully that explains it. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Listen, I'm going to do a little President's Trivia for very valuable prizes. So I'm going to take the third caller to the station, and if you get five or more answers right, you get a very valuable prize. Call us at 312-981-7200. It's Karen Conti on WGN. President's Day, we're going to have a little trivia competition, and Bob is going to join us on the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Bob. Are you ready for the trivia competition?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, no Googling. You can't Google real fast, right?
Yeah, right.
Do you have your right hand up, and you swear on your radio that you will not Google during this time, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Ready? If you get more than half of them right, you will get a book called The Heart of the Fight, which is written by Drs. Judith and Bob Wright, and it's about how to fight in a relationship to keep your relationship. It's a great book. All right. Here we go. These are all multiple choice, Bob. Who is the tallest president? A, Donald Trump. B, Herbert Hoover. C, Abraham Lincoln. Or D, Gerald Ford?
I'll go with Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln, it is. At 6'4", he is the tallest. He is the tallest. Now, Donald Trump may say he's the tallest. He says he's the best everything, but he's not. You're right. There you go. You got one. You keeping score, Jerry? My husband's keeping score. All right, here we go. One for one. This president would paint golf balls black during the winter so he could play in the snow. Who was it? A, Woodrow Wilson. B, Theodore Roosevelt. C, John Kennedy. Or D, Bill Clinton. Who had black golf balls?
Hmm.
All right, Bob.
Eisenhower?
No, and actually that wasn't even one of the choices. It was Woodrow Wilson. Yes, he did. He loved to golf so much he had to do it in the winter. All right, here we go. Next question. Who was the first president to travel outside the United States on official business? A. George Washington to England. B. Abraham Lincoln to Mexico. C. Ulysses Grant to Puerto Rico. Or D. Theodore Roosevelt to Panama. The first president to travel outside the United States.
Well, one of them we can eliminate. Puerto Rico's like the United States with a territory. I'll go with Theodore Roosevelt.
That's right. You are right. In 1906, Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to travel outside the United States to Panama. Very good. Here we go. Ready? Which president was not married in office? Which one of these presidents was not married while he was president? A. Grover Cleveland. B. John Tyler. C. James Garfield. Or D. Woodrow Wilson.
James Garfield?
That's right. He was the only president who was not married in office. Grover Cleveland was the only president in history who was actually married in the White House. That's good. You're doing well. Jerry, what's the score here?
Three right and one wrong.
Okay, here we go. The only man to serve as President of the United States and Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. A. William Taft. B. John Adams. C. Andrew Jackson. Or D. James Polk.
That'll be William Taft.
That's good. How did you know that? Just curious.
Well, I remember we have the school here in the city named after him.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay, now this is, and William Taft was also, this is a bonus point for you. William Taft was also one of two presidents buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Can you name the other president?
I'll go with John Kennedy.
That's right. You are really doing well here. Very, very good. All right. Who is the first president born in a hospital? A. John Kennedy. B. Lyndon Johnson. C. Jimmy Carter. Or D. Andrew Jackson.
I remember that. Jimmy Carter.
Oh, my gosh. Look at this guy. You are a presidential historian. Jimmy Carter was the first U.S. president born in a hospital in Plains, Georgia in 1924. All right. Who was the first president whose mother was able to vote for him for president? A. Theodore Roosevelt. B. Franklin Roosevelt. C. John Kennedy. Or D. Herbert Hoover. First president whose mother was able to vote for him.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt.
That's right. That's fabulous. He, women got the right to vote roughly 1920. I think it was passed in 1919. It was ratified and went into effect in 1920. And he was elected in 1932. Franklin Roosevelt. Very good. All right. Who was the only bachelor president that we've had? A. Herbert Hoover. B. Calvin Coolidge. C. James Buchanan. Or D. William McKinley.
That was James Buchanan.
That was. Now, how do you know that?
I remember that from way back.
Okay. And he had a male friend, and no one knows anything about it, but he was the only bachelor in the history of U.S. presidents. I mean, I think you've already won, but I just want you to show off some more. Here we go. Who is the only president to receive a patent? George Washington for wooden teeth? Abraham Lincoln for a type of voting device? Ulysses Grant for a type of pistol, or Herbert Hoover for a device to reduce the wasting of stored food?
I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln.
That's right. Abraham Lincoln was, it was a device that would help lift boats over coal shoals because he had actually gotten stranded a couple of times. And one time he was stranded in the Sangamon River, which is goes through Springfield, and he ended up in New Salem, which is where he was the postmaster, and he had a little shop there. So that was his patent for the boating device. All right, last one. You're doing unbelievably well. The three best-known Western names in China are Jesus Christ, Elvis Presley and this president? A, Bill Clinton, B, Richard Nixon, C, George Bush, or D, John Kennedy?
I'm going to say Kennedy. I don't know why.
It's Richard Nixon. Very interesting. But what was the score, Jerry?
10 out of 12.
Yeah, 10 out of 12. Bob, that's absolutely fabulous. I would call you a presidential historian. Bob is going to receive a copy of Heart of the Fight by the Wright, couple's name, Drs. Wright. And it's a very good book. We had their, they had them on a couple of weeks ago, and I think you'll enjoy reading it. But thank you for playing, Bob. You did very well.
Thank you.
I'm going to put you on hold, and you're going to give Cash your address so we can mail you this very valuable prize. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the Karen Conti Show. Again, I'm going to give out my phone number at the office, 312-332-7800. I'm always happy to take your calls or take your emails to try to steer you in the right legal direction, and my email is WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Happy President's Day, and have a good week.